Blog Talk Radio.
It's simply not enough to commemorate the 82nd birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We must examine the valuable and vital and volatile background of the Civil Rights era and how courageous men and women and children put their lives on the line for social justice. That change is soaked in blood and brought about a sweeping reform in the United States and other parts of the world. Today is also the 50th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's inauguration as President of the United States and also the second anniversary of President Barack Obama's inauguration. Historic day, historic times. We're talking about change and what has change done for you lately. This is Carol Copeland Thomas, and you're listening to Focus on Empowerment. Hello, everyone. This is Carol Copeland Thomas, and I am so glad you're listening to Focus on Empowerment. We are well into January. There are weather issues, I'm sure, wherever you happen to be. Just bundle up and stay warm if you are in the lower 48s where snow is on the ground in many of our states. It certainly is here in Massachusetts with another snowstorm coming tomorrow. But, hey, that's winter, and as we say in New England, just stick around. The weather will change. I am just struck by all of the sequences of events that are happening today. I talked about this being the 50th anniversary of the inauguration of John F. Kennedy, and wherever you happen to be, you can go online and hear his famous inaugural speech talking about ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. We know that Sergeant Shriver passed away a few days ago, and the remarkable breadth of activities and initiatives that he either managed or started, including the Peace Corps and the job training programs across the United States. And then we're talking about Martin Luther King Jr. Well, I want to bring on a very special friend of mine, and I've known her for many years, and she is a leading expert in the field of sociology and African-American studies. She is actually the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Professor of Sociology and African-American Studies at Colby College. You're wondering, where is that? That's in Waterville, Maine. She's been there for 23-plus years, since 1987. She is my sorority sister and just a fabulous, insightful historian, sociologist, and theologian as well, the Reverend Dr. Cheryl Townsend Giltz. Welcome to Focus on Empowerment.
Thank you so much for that wonderful, inspiring, and energizing welcome. I am so happy to be able to talk to you today.
You're also a radio personality like I am, too. You've been spinning gospel music for quite a while up there in Maine. Is that right, Cheryl?
Since 2002, I've had a show titled The Uncloudy Day on the on our college radio station, WMHB, Waterville.
I love that.
Every Wednesday morning at 8 o'clock, you know I'm going to put in a plug. We have two hours of good news power for your gospel music listening, and people can get us on the web.
Give us the website.
www.wmhb.org. And as I say to everyone, tune in every Wednesday morning at 8 a.m. and let me love your ears with this music that I love, which is also the music that Dr. King loved.
This past
Wednesday I did a show celebrating his life and work. That's another reason I'm so happy, glad to talk to you, because 2 hours wasn't enough, and I could talk all day about the importance of Dr. King.
And let's begin that conversation. The more and more I think about what he did, and having the privilege of going to one of his rallies in June of 1963, I'm from Detroit, and a prelude to the March on Washington.
Yes,
was
that was
his
a key,
I Have a Dream speech.
Key
yes.
rally. Yes.
In Detroit, and I was there. My uncle is from Columbus, Georgia, was from Columbus, and he took me there. I was, 9 years old.
Yeah.
And went and heard that. So, I mean, we all have our, if you're in our age category.
And one of the organizers of the march was the Reverend C.L. Franklin, the father
of
Aretha.
Yeah. That's right. So troops, Aretha Franklin. So, I mean, we all have our Martin moments, whatever they happen to be. What is your Martin moment?
I'm not sure, because I reached a point as a kid once the civil rights movement got going, and my family actually bought a television, because my parents wouldn't buy a television at first because they were afraid I wouldn't read. And so I had to read about things in newspapers like the Afro-American and the Pittsburgh Courier and the Boston Chronicle. And I often tell my students, I can remember as a child sitting on the floor reading the Afro-American, and my mother was one of those women who insisted that when you wanted to know what a word was, you had to sound it out. And I can remember asking my mother, "Mommy, what is this word? Segregation." And then she had, you know, then I had to learn to pronounce it properly, segregation. And, of course, we're growing up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where Jim Crow, as we know it in the South, didn't exist, although discriminations of a wide variety existed, but you had to identify them, pull them up out from under the covers, and then name them. And my mother adapted it to my childhood understanding. But I remember the article was about de facto and de jure, which I later learned is de jure because of the Latin pronunciation. And so I was conscious of the civil rights movement. And when I was 12, on Saturdays, we would all go to the Central Square Theater. And before we would go to the Central Square Theater, we would go to Kresge's across the street and buy this huge bag of popcorn for 10 cents so that we wouldn't have to spend a whole quarter inside the theater for the popcorn that had the butter on it. And I went to get my money for my popcorn and my theater admission one Saturday. And my mother, she gave me my admission money, but not the money for popcorn. "You're not buying popcorn at Kresge's today." "Why am I not buying popcorn at Kresge's today?" "Because we are boycotting Woolworths." "But Kresge's is across the street from Woolworths. Why are we boycotting Kresge's?" "Because it is not fair for Kresge's to make money because we are boycotting Woolworths." And I was, and I knew because I had been reading the newspapers that these things were going on. But I hadn't quite. I get to Central Square, and I never got to the theater that day. I joined the picket line in front of Woolworths and was very, very cold because it was a very cold day. Because, of course, it was February. This was 1960. Then and two students from Brandeis drove me home. It was my first ride in a Volkswagen Bug. And when you're a kid, you know, these things, you know. So, you know, I did what you're not supposed to do, get in a car with strangers. I never went to the movie, which my mother thought I was at the movie. I'm out marching in front of a Woolworths with a ticket sign in my hand. And my fifth grade teacher had brought in a book that talked about Martin Luther King. So when he came to Cambridge to speak, we canceled BYF one Sunday to go to First Baptist Church in Central Square. But I would run home every day, now that we had a television, and I was allowed to watch the news, to see what Dr. King said today. I would literally turn on the news every day to see what Dr. King said and where he was.
He was a magnet, the type of personality that would draw people, regardless of who you happen to be. Here, you've given your experience about growing up in Cambridge and ended up participating in a picket. I'm in Detroit catching the bus downtown with my uncle. All I remember, just a sea of people to hear this one man and just the words. He was in many ways a poet. You've mentioned the Afro-American newspaper, which is based in Baltimore, and ironically, talking about how connected we are, that publisher is very good friends of my family. In fact, Jake Oliver was my brother's best man at his wedding. So, you know, the connections are certainly there. And in fact, we have Dr. Rhonda Waters in our chat room, and she says she remembers old Kresge's well, and what a great story of place with context. Absolutely. So, I mean, we can always, if you're in that era, you can remember something that happened or something where you were, just like I remember November 22nd, 1963, when John F. Kennedy was shot and killed. I was in art class. And Brian Beckwith ran in the class and gave us this news. So we have those kind of memories of the 60s. And as I mentioned earlier in my introduction, it was filled with volatility, with value, I mean, soaked in blood. And here, Dr. King and many, many others who will never know all of their names, many women, many men, many children, they put their lives on the line for a cause.
Yes.
And you're a college professor. You've been at Colby for many years. Give me a sense of the context of the importance of college students and the civil rights movement in the era of King.
I do this to my students routinely. I tell them when they have their 26th birthday, I want them to think, what am I doing now? To understand that Dr. King, at the age of 26, had finished a doctoral degree and was pastoring a major church in Montgomery, Alabama, and that he was chosen for the leadership of the Montgomery Improvement Association as this boycott went forward. But I also remind them that when Dr. King came to Boston, he was already an accomplished preacher.
Right.
I grew up in the Union Baptist Church, whose pastor at the time was Reverend Marvin Gibson, who was ill. And so Dr. King used to come over and sit in the back row with Mrs. King, and when the deacons would see him there, they would call him up and ask him to preach. And there are several people at Union Baptist who have baptismal certificates signed by Dr. King. Now, I was too little to remember. My mom says that I met him and I've talked to him, but I have no memory of that because I was too little. But the point is that he was their age. I try to get the students to understand this is a man who was in his 20s, who very quickly went through undergraduate school, got his Master of Divinity at Crozier, which is now part of Colgate Rochester Divinity School, and then came to Boston and finished the PhD. But then I also, I teach a course called Civil Rights, Black Power, and Social Change, where I use all 14 episodes of Eyes on the Prize. And I make the point about students in February 1960 engaged in these sit-ins that sweep across the South, the emergence of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I show them videos of films about Ella Baker, and there's a wonderful film called Fundy, The Life of Ella Baker, and it reviews her life and also interviews the students in SNCC who were...
which is the
Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Ella Baker was the first executive director of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and then facilitated or midwifed the birth of Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee by having a student conference on Easter weekend of 1960 after the sit-ins had started, and encouraged the students to be their own organization. And, of course, she very patiently, as they said, explained to them and got them to understand the importance of the ministers with whom they were often rebelling against. You know, I left home, he can't tell me what to do, that kind of thing.
Right,
at the same
time,
she was defending the students from the takeover by the ministers. So there it was all of this wonderful stuff. But I say to the students, like you, the Mississippi Freedom Summer, 1964, these are students like you whose activism changed America. Not only did it advance the voting rights agenda, but many of, and there's a wonderful book by a man named Douglas McAdam called Freedom Summer, which details the consequences of all of those white volunteers who went to Mississippi. And you find out that many of the activists who were foundational to the anti-war movement, to the women's movement, to the gay liberation movement, those activists spent that summer in 1964 in the COFO summer, the Council of Federated Organization summer, and working with SNCC and CORE in Mississippi. So,
and now you see, listeners, why I have Dr. Cheryl Townsend Jokes on my show. She has clearly a photographic memory and is painting the picture of all of the convergence of activities that were going on during this time. I wanted to ask you also, and this is what young people need to realize as well, and then I want to talk about one or two of his letters, particularly the letter from the Birmingham jail.
Yeah.
People don't realize that this was a movement that was more than the highlight that we are aware of was at least 10 years old. It started in the early 50s and then, you know, culminated with Dr. King's death. But even before that, there were many activities going on in the 30s and the 40s that ramped up to the civil rights era, particularly with A. Philip Randolph and the Porters and what then led to the March on Washington. So I think it's important for young people and for those who were disengaged with this or maybe have had a change of heart in terms of that era to understand the length of time and the breadth of activities that took place for not a year or two, but for many, many years.
The legacy of struggle, the legacy of resistance reaches deep, and we could spend hours just detailing the organizational histories that connect, like the bones in Ezekiel's Valley of Dry Bones, to get us to the point where civil rights is on a national agenda. And look at all of the people who pushed, who argued with one another, who debated with one another. Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, the emergence of the of people like Mary McLeod Bethune, who prodded and pushed and utilized her relationship with Eleanor Roosevelt to get Franklin Delano Roosevelt to listen to black advisors like herself, like A. Philip Randolph, like a number of people who were part of this black cabinet and who pushed black Americans to also participate in the war effort as a way of humanizing, the emergence of the double V, the victory overseas and victory at home. In fact, my students are going to see a film tomorrow called Soldiers Without Swords, which details the role of the black press in all of this, in providing.
So again, I mean, you're talking about important historical figures, certainly presidents, the President Roosevelt, his wife, who was extremely influential, but again, an evolution that ultimately led to what
you
now
you
know
have
as the civil rights era.
In Chicago, the sit-in started by CORE. I mean, you have so many different activities. You have Charles Hamilton Houston, who reorganizes Howard University Law School and develops the legal strategy that begins a series of cases that culminate in the six cases that are summarized by the term Brown versus Board of Education. So and the emergence of Thurgood Marshall as the point person for that, arguing that strategy. Thurgood Marshall and Constance Baker Motley, who is the key lawyer arguing for James Meredith's admission to the University of Mississippi.
On a parallel track, you're talking about activities of revolution and change from a nonviolent perspective going on in India that influenced Dr. King. I just want to read a little piece from Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, who was the great ruler in India, who was unfortunately also assassinated. And these are the eight blunders that cause all the violence in the world. He says, wealth without work, pleasure without conscience, knowledge without character, commerce without morality, science without humanity, worship without sacrifice, politics without principles, and rights without responsibility, all leading to great violence in the world. And then let me read a comment from Dr. Waters, who is listening in the chat room. She says, Dr. King reminds me to think about larger things in life, not only about myself and my little world, but about my brothers and sisters everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that's a sense of the here and now. Do you think that students today on your campus have. Now, obviously, we're talking about a different era altogether.
Very
and I think it's unfair for anybody
era.
To compare the times that we're living in now with the times 50 years ago. But all things considered, what can you say about the essence of students today when we reflect on Dr. King, Dr. Jilks?
One of the things I learn about students is because the civil rights movement and other parallel or movements that follow, depending on how you define what is a civil rights movement, but all of this activity around racial justice has succeeded in some ways to a point where students have no real idea how deeply transformed and changed America became, because they've grown up in an era when there is no de jure segregation. They really have no idea what they have some idea, but they really don't have a clear idea of all of the effort and at change, and very often they have a collapsed and somewhat tunnelized vision of race and social change in America. There was slavery, Reconstruction, the civil rights movement, and now. And so so things have been flattened, and because
in a nice little package handed to them.
Yeah. Right. And one of the things that the successes of the civil rights movement did was to move certain obstacles out of the way. Once you get Jim Crow, once you get de jure segregation out of the way, one gets to see more complicated dimensions of social inequality and social injustice. And those are not as compactly addressed and summarized to mobilize people in this era. So the analysis is a lot more complex, and the choices of action, if one is going to serve and be activist, are much broader and much more difficult to address. I mean, addressing poverty in America, do we just feed and house people who are homeless and without meals? How do we, as people activists in the world today, address the larger issues of poverty? Is it only the policy wonks who can make the Jeffrey Sachses of the world, the various radical economists who are speaking to the UN and others? Do we have to be part of an elite summit in some of the organizations that meet in Switzerland, et cetera, to deal with the problems of the world? How do we do this? Where do we
start? The world is,
King would say, where do we go from here?
Where do we go from here? I mean, the world obviously is more complicated now. Technology certainly has streamlined it to a point, but their principles and the value of human life and dignity is still one that we really struggle with. I want to also read what Joan Davenport, my good friend in Pennsylvania, Norristown, Pennsylvania, has said on my Facebook page. For me, and the question was, what does Dr. King mean to you? And this is how she responds. For me, it means, through his teaching, I can hold my head high and know I, too, am somebody, that I, too, can make a difference, that I, too, can understand it is important to extend oneself, to encourage others to set goals for themselves, and to strive to be the very best person you can be. That is what Dr. King's legacy means to me. And then one of the alums from Colby College, Jeff Stone, has made these comments. He said, every time I hear recordings of Dr. King speaking, or even when someone else is reading his words, my feelings for idealism and hope and indignation at injustice are instantly rekindled. He had a noble, holy gift. Don't know of anyone else like him. The national holiday created in his honor was well justified. So this is just a couple of comments that came in through Facebook about Dr. King. He was such a unique person. I mean, and someone, he was flawed. He was human.
Yeah.
He made mistakes. And I think so often we put these people on pedestals, and and then when something happens or you read something about them, then you want to instantly take them down. But in his case, he was just a remarkable clairvoyant visionary who realized that the path he was going down in life could cost him his life.
Yeah.
Dr. Jokes?
Yes. Hello.
What are your thoughts? Yes, I'm here. What are your thoughts about his sacrifice, his personal sacrifice, given what you've talked about with students today and people today and how we're focused on our own lives and how that is contrary to the sacrifice of the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s in places like the South and across the United States?
Well, the personal sacrifice was real. The threat of violence was there. His very first campaign, his very first public activity involving the Montgomery bus boycott, it is his home that is bombed. So his being identified as the leader had costs attached to it, which almost cost him the lives of his wife and his baby, his newborn baby. And that's a significant cost. The fact that he and his wife and Coretta Scott King was an active participant in all of this made the decision to approach the issue of social change nonviolently. She, who was a specially, it's like the two of them were specially prepared for our society because she came with that education from Antioch College that also prepared her for leadership. Here were two people
right.
educated for leadership who took seriously their responsibilities to utilize all of their gifts on behalf the nation. So the fact that he was surrounded
by other people who also had that level of education and discipline and self-sacrifice. My dear friends are the Abernathys. Juanita Abernathy is still alive and well.
Yeah.
And I just, her home was bombed 44, or at least, no, her husband was jailed 44 times.
Yeah.
Their home was bombed. And just think about, again, the self-sacrifice. You put your children at risk for a cause that is greater than you. That's the astounding thing that I'm thinking about.
They were targets of violence.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to get my students to understand the importance, for instance, during the Kennedy campaign when John F. Kennedy called Mrs. King and Robert Kennedy went to work appealing to the Justice Department and others who had the power to get Dr. King off the prison farm in Georgia because
mm-hmm.
every black person in America knew that sending him to a prison farm could possibly mean his death. And most people to this day have no idea what those southern prison farms were like and what they were aimed at doing. But I showed just recently in class an episode of The Rise and Fall of Jim Crow, which is a wonderful
mm-hmm.
video series, and Volume 2 actually focuses in on those prison camps because in the South, the criminal justice system was used as a way of replacing slavery. And the death rates, the cruelty, the nonsensical sentences for nonsensical offenses that
mm-hmm.
got people into these farms meant that they had a 45, the death rates sometimes were 45%.
Right.
So
well,
people knew that King could die. And
he could die there. And let's look at the modern day version of.
That was one of the reasons that people supported Kennedy. Those black people who could vote, especially in the North, supported Kennedy.
And think about the connection between these two young women who were just recently released from the Mississippi prison system after serving, 15 years or so for an armed robbery case back in the 90s where they got a total of $11.
And garnered life sentences.
Absolutely. So, you can draw those kind of comparisons, too. I want to read a little bit, speaking of jail, the jail time that Dr. King spent in Birmingham, and just
mm-hmm.
a setup for those of you who are not familiar with what happened then, in the midst of his protesting, he was in jail, and a group of ministers, clergymen of all religious faiths were criticizing the demonstrations going on, and they were calling Dr. King and his leaders extremists. So while he's sitting in jail for one of his protests, he started writing, somebody had slipped him a newspaper, He starts writing on the margins of a newspaper, and then somebody else slipped him some writing paper in to become now what is the famous letter from the Birmingham jail that is several pages long, but you have to read it. I'm going to post it on my Facebook page. I talked about it last week. And one of the sentences he has in here is, I am cognizant of the interrelatedness of all communities and states. I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inexplicable network of mutuality tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever happens, whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Dr. Cheryl Townsend-Jilks, your thoughts and comments about his writing, about his poetic style, and what these words meant in during that era.
Well, first of all, I have routinely, when I have been asked to speak about or talk about King, I immediately recommend a wonderful big volume titled Testament of Hope, the Essential Writings of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. for anyone who wants to grasp Dr. King's writing perspective in a holistic way. This is the best introduction, and it does include the letter to the Birmingham jail, and it includes excerpts from his various books. We tend to celebrate Dr. King as if there was the Montgomery bus boycott and then there was the March on Washington.
And that's it.
We forget that August of 1963, Dr. King works and writes for five more years. And he writes a wonderful book. In fact, the speaker at the Boston Breakfast this year highlighted that book. The book is titled Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community? And one of the things that my students did recognize when we used that book in a reading seminar was that all of the things that Dr. King was talking about in the various essays, sermons, speeches were issues that are still with us. The issues of violence, the issues of inequality, the issues of inhumanity. And King, in a very sophisticated way, even addresses issues of cultural erasure in what we now call a multicultural society. The word multicultural was not part of his vocabulary. It wasn't part of our general vocabulary in 1968. But he addresses those issues. He talks about some of the implications that go along with desegregation. How do we make sure that everybody is included in the public consciousness by way of school curricula, et cetera? So his speaking out about Vietnam, yesterday on my show, on my annual celebration of King, I actually play a sermon by a contemporary of his, the great Reverend Dr. Gardner C. Taylor, who preached this wonderful tribute sermon in 1972 titled The Strange Ways of God. And he reminds us about Dr. King's speaking out against the war in Vietnam, and that Dr. King said to President Johnson and Dean Rusk, say we made a mistake. In other words, speaking truth to power. Yes, we can say we were wrong and come out. And if you notice, even today, there is a resistance in America to American self-criticism, so much so that after President Obama is inaugurated, his enemies start calling him an apologist for America and calling his outreach to other nations his apology tour. And I really resent that, because at sometimes under some conditions, if great nations cannot criticize themselves and say we need to do things differently, we will cease to be great nations. And Dr. King understood this.
And that's where he was clairvoyant again. And he was not afraid of criticism. He was and certainly with this very long letter he writes in jail, and just the beauty of the words, speaking about the issues. He talks about some of these beautiful churches that he had witnessed, and he wants to know, where is God in their church? So, I mean, he was not afraid to bring truth to the table and do it in a way where you had to stop and really, really search your soul for an answer. And that's what, in many cases, is missing today as we look at polls and we look at data and
mm-hmm.
people are looking for 30-second sound bites and not being as true as they should be.
Yeah, he...
And in our
yeah, in the letter from the Birmingham jail, he talks about religious leaders. He says, I have heard numerous Southern religious leaders admonish their worshipers to comply with a desegregation decision because it is the law. But I have longed to hear white ministers declare, follow this decree because integration is morally right and because the Negro is your brother. And then he goes on to say, you know, yes, I see the church as the body of Christ, but yes, I see the church as the body of Christ, but oh, how we have blemished and scarred that body through social neglect and through fear of being nonconformists. So rich.
Yeah. And so contemporary.
Yep.
So contemporary. Chat room, our friend Dr. Waters says King was so ill-treated because of his Vietnam troops. We know about that, and very good point about the need to admit wrongdoing. And again, but when you are really caught up in being a conformist and not sort of shaking the basket or rocking the boat, it pulls you back because you become reluctant to really speak the truth when it should be spoken because you're concerned about the consequences. And I don't think it's right to say that all the individuals, bus drivers, maids, people who worked in cafeterias or whatever during that era, they were afraid because many of them lost their jobs by certainly with the Montgomery bus boycott and others, but there was something bigger than they that caused them to move forward for justice and truth.
I sometimes wonder if the reason so many people were still alive and able to be interviewed for Eyes on the Prize and other documentaries that have been made is precisely because people walked those long distances for that year, and we now know that walking is one of the best exercises for human beings. And they did all of that walking in the days before there was Nike and Reebok and all of these other good shoes to use, and yet they engage in a behavior that was healthy beyond healthy in order to make our society more socially and morally healthy. It just impresses me. Getting students to understand how organized the resistance was to the civil rights movement, and that we need to be aware of that and understand that, you know, people can still threaten and intimidate in ways today without ever saying the word race to really push and reinforce all kinds of inequality and injustice.
True.
We must be aware. And it requires the kind of analytical depth that Dr. King had, which we understate so often because his rhetoric was so embracing and so inspiring.
Powerful.
That we
mm-hmm.
sometimes miss the sophisticated
the
analysis that
yeah.
is also in the longer pieces, the books and the essays.
Dr. Cheryl Townsend-Jilks, we're talking to the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Professor of Sociology and African American Studies and also the Assistant Pastor for Special Projects at Union Baptist Church here in Cambridge, Dr. Cheryl Townsend-Jilks. In, let's say, 30 seconds or less, tell us or give us a sense of where do we go from here, given our two wars, our recession that we're still trying to climb out of, unemployment issues, and a myriad of political affronts that we are facing. Where do we, people on the planet, people in the United States and elsewhere, where do we go from here based on a King model?
On a King model, one of the things that we need to do is learn the truth of our circumstances here in the United States with all of our various social problems, because there are so many voices out there that are tied up and tangled up with making points that are destructive. We often don't know the truth, and one of the things that King, I think, would say to us today, you need to know the truth about the real situation of the poor, the real situation of the economy, the real situation of international struggles and issues of militarism. We need to know the real truth. And once we know those real truths, we will be able not only to be set free, but to act in ways that set our brothers and sisters free and really see the familyhood of humanity. I think some of his words from the letter, where he gets to the end of that letter and he says, "I hope this letter finds you strong in the faith. I also hope that circumstances will soon make it possible for me to meet each of you, not as an integrationist or a civil rights leader, but as a fellow clergyman and a Christian brother. Let us all hope that the dark clouds of racial prejudice will soon pass away and the deep fog of misunderstanding will be lifted from our fear-drenched communities, and in some not too distant tomorrow, the radiant stars of love and brotherhood," and I'm sure if he were alive today, he would say love and siblinghood, "will shine over our great nation with all their scintillating beauty." So
Dr.
I think
Cheryl
we still
Townsend
need to
Jill.
Strive for that familyhood of humanity that was part of his vision.
Thank you so much for being a guest on my program. Dr. Cheryl Townsend-Jilks is the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Professor of Sociology and African American Studies at Colby College in Waterville, Maine, and also the Assistant Pastor of Special Projects for Union Baptist Church in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You have been a delightful guest. Thank you
and
so much for being on my show today.
And I have enjoyed talking to you, my soror, Carol Copeland Thomas. Thank you for this wonderful time of empowerment together.
Thank you so much, and all the best with all your classes. Take care.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye
God
now.
God bless you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
God bless. Well, we are definitely going to have her back on. She is a wealth of knowledge and just a delight to have on the show as we reflect on Dr. King. We're going to reflect on him with our next guest in just a few minutes. She's standing by. I want to talk to you just for a few minutes about Connections Magazine. That is the multicultural magazine that we are starting in the spring. Have a little announcement to play for you. It'll reference the holiday pricing that we are actually extending through January 31st, Connections Magazine, and here we go.
Connections Magazine is the magazine for you. We're looking for advertisers like you to be a part of our very first premier issue. Corporations, educational institutions, government agencies, nonprofit organizations, small businesses, entrepreneurs, community advocates, individuals, faith-based organizations, sororities and fraternities, associations, families, and those placing a memorial tribute. Connections is a news and professional development publication targeted at a multicultural audience of professionals, advocates, and emerging leaders who are making a positive impact on a globally diverse world. Our first issue of the specialty magazine will debut in the spring of 2011. The initial print run will be 10,000 to 15,000 copies distributed across Massachusetts, New England, and across the United States. This issue will have a special emphasis on global diversity and inclusion, its people, businesses, institutions, and organizations that impact the marketplace in our globally connected world. Our special holiday pricing provides you with an opportunity to select your advertising space in a cost-effective manner before the prices go up at the end of the month. When you advertise by December 21st, you save lots of dollars on your ad. Plus, you'll receive the free memberships in the Multicultural Symposium Series when you advertise in Connections. Pricing just right for your organization, large or small. And individuals can also advertise. To receive a media kit with pricing, please email me at tellcarol@mac.com. That's tellcarole@mac.com. And put Connections Media Kit in the subject line. Please indicate if you're a small business, nonprofit, or an individual. Or you can call me at 508-947-5755 if you have any questions or comments. I'm Carol Copeland Thomas, and I'm excited about Connections Magazine and want you to be a part of our big debut. Show your commitment to multiculturalism, global diversity, and inclusion. Advertise in Connections today.
And we will definitely have some kind of highlight or tribute to Martin Luther King in our upcoming issue of Connections Magazine. So we would love for you to be on board as an advertiser or as a sponsor. We thank everyone who is on board to date, and we are looking for more advertisers like you. It's going to be a great publication, and it certainly will be the continuation of all of the struggles and achievements and triumphs of those who have come before me and you. Connections Magazine. Got to switch gears now and bring on a very special guest talking about a program that is so important when we're looking at what is happening with our young people who, for some reason, get off track and end up in prison so young. There's going to be a special coalition meeting to dismantle the Cradle to the Prison Pipeline here in the Boston area on January 25th from 9 until 12 at the City Year headquarters at 287 Columbus Avenue in Boston. And talking about that is a member of the Children's Defense Fund, one of the most respected organizations in the country. Barbara Best, thank you so much for being a guest on my program.
Thank you.
Tell us more about the coalition itself and what the purpose is of this Cradle to Pipeline Prevention Program.
The Cradle to Prison Pipeline campaign is a national initiative of the Children's Defense Fund to stop the funneling of young people down life paths that lead to arrest, incarceration, and in some cases, death. And the statistics are just alarming. An African-American boy born in 2001 has a 1 in 3 chance of going to prison at some point in his lifetime, and a Latino boy a 1 in 6 risk of the same fate. And the idea behind this campaign is that the only guarantee we give an American child is a jail cell after they get into trouble, that we're not providing the preventive supports that children need to become healthy and productive members of our community. And so we're here to name this pipeline and then to systematically take it down and replace it with a pipeline towards college and productive work.
I know that Marion Wright Edelman certainly goes back to the civil rights era. She certainly is a pioneer, the head and the leader of the Children's Defense Fund. How important is this for her as a visionary, as she's looking and as you, Barbara Best, are looking at some of the issues that we're facing, not just here in Boston, but certainly around the country?
Well, this is the top priority of the Children's Defense Fund to dismantle the Mrs. Edelman has been an advocate for children for her entire professional life. She was Dr. Martin Luther King's legal counsel during the Poor People's Campaign that he began organizing before his assassination, and she has continued to carry the torch. And these times are very frightening. Michelle Alexander writes in her book, The New Jim Crow, that there are more African-Americans incarcerated now than 10 years before the Civil War. It's very frightening, and so we've got to step up and speak out about what's happening. And we unveiled our Cradle to Prison Pipeline campaign at Howard University in 2007 and have had summits throughout the United States. And so we're very eager to kick off a campaign in Boston and Massachusetts to dismantle the pipeline here. The data, it's alarming. We talked about the incarceration risk, but also when it certainly doesn't make sense to send so many children into the juvenile justice system, but also from a financial standpoint, it just doesn't make any sense. It costs about $1,000 a year for a mentoring program for a child. It costs about $10,000 a year for public education per child, but it costs $50,000 to incarcerate a child for a year in Massachusetts. And so where are we going to invest our dollars? Are we going to invest in preventive care for children, or are we going to invest in crisis care after children get sick or into trouble or drop out of school or suffer family breakdown? And we believe that we know, all of us know, what choice we need to make, and that is to invest in preventive supports to help our children reach their full potential.
I want to talk to you about this actual meeting that's coming up, but I just want to back up and ask you, with your research, this program has been going on now for almost 4 years, started in 2007. Are you seeing, what are the patterns that you're seeing where a young person, with a bright mind, great future at 2 or 3 years old, then are you tracking in terms of when these distractions get in the way of that young person staying on track? What are some of the problems? How do they become casualties so soon?
That's a great question. And, you know, it's helpful, I think, to look at these systems fueling the pipeline, that from the day that tens of thousands of children are born, they are sucked into this pipeline, and it's fueled by pervasive poverty. So parents, two parents working minimum wage jobs, but still below the poverty level. So parents working two or three jobs, but still can't make ends meet. Racial disparities, inadequate health and mental health care, gaps in early childhood development, and that data is truly staggering, that by age three, children from a low socioeconomic status have one-third the vocabulary of their more affluent peers. And so just think of where by kindergarten, think of when they're going to be by fourth grade or by high school graduation. They're just on that track towards the pipeline. Disparate educational opportunities, chronic abuse and neglect, and overburdened and ineffective juvenile justice systems that are punitive in their approach and don't support rehabilitation. And so all of these systems work to funnel children into the pipeline. And our experience in a number of states, the Children's Defense Fund has offices covering 15 states and has advocates on the ground in all 50 states, is that what we've got to do is to try to move the needle on a specific pipeline impact point. And so in New York, there's an opportunity now to close down these upstate juvenile detention centers and to invest in community-based alternatives. In Massachusetts, we want to focus on the role that zero-tolerance school discipline policies play in funneling children into the pipeline. There's some 60,000 of these school exclusions every year. Half of them are for nonviolent, non-criminal offenses like disturbing an assembly or talking back to a teacher. Do these need to be handled with out-of-school suspension? Because that's putting children on the track to dropping out, and that's not what we want to be doing.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you say that, Barbara. Years ago when my late son, my son passed away right after high school, but in his junior year, he got into an altercation with another student. They had a fight, and it got kind of ugly. I was so concerned. And he was a good kid, was in honors classes, but I was so concerned about him having a record, possibly getting arrested. I had a heart-to-heart talk with the parents of the other student. Now, mind you, the young man that he had this altercation with, they were friends. They fell out, they had a fight. And I stayed with those parents and worked with those parents so that we got this matter resolved, because I was so concerned about a record and him being an African-American young male and having a record and possibly having that causing him to become derailed. Do you find that parents are doing all that they can to make sure that particularly their young black male sons are on a path for creativity and healthy living instead of being on this pipeline track that you are looking at and researching?
That's a great question. And what really concerns me is what I see is that parents are doing their best, and yet, you know, school police officers, like the New York City School Police Force, is one of the largest in the world. In Holyoke, 44% of children entering the juvenile detention facilities are referred by schools. And so I've been compiling this list of stories that I carry around with me. You know, would you call the police if a 10-year-old elementary school student took a pair of scissors out of her backpack during class? That's a real story. Would you call the police if a 7-year-old boy threw a backpack at a classmate? If a 5-year-old boy was misbehaving in school, and there's that example of Jaisha Scott in St. Petersburg, Florida, where she, kindergarten student, got frustrated during a jelly bean counting contest, was sent to the principal's office, was clearly distressed, and no one tried to help her. And three police officers came. They shackled her. They held her in the police car until her mother was able to get her. And the only reason that we know about that case is it was caught on tape. And I just wonder how many other cases are there like that? We're criminalizing our children at younger and younger ages.
There are lots of them like that. And again, it takes the children.
For what you did in that situation, but what are we to do when, you know, school police officers are arresting children for this, you know, nonviolent, very discretionary sort of behavioral issues? It's disturbing.
Well, tell us
so
about,
we want to shine a light on this.
Yeah. Tell us about the coalition meeting. Tell us about the coalition meeting here in Massachusetts and who's going to participate, and give us more details about that meeting on January 25th.
Sure. Well, we're meeting at City Year on January 25th from 9 a.m. to 12 noon. We got 134 RSVPs already, and we've got a really diverse group. We've got faith leaders and
great
young people and agency administrators, educators, everyone coming to the table to talk about how do we move forward. And so the Rennie Center will be there giving us a kind of a snapshot on school discipline issues in Massachusetts, and then we'll break into different task forces and have some small group strategy sessions where we can talk about how are we going to promote alternatives to zero tolerance. I've been going around and meeting with people. I'm very impressed. Suffolk University is doing some compelling work on restorative justice, and I learned about Charleston High School, where there were lots of fights among ninth grade girls, and so they divided all ninth grade girls into groups of 10 with a female staff member and did peacemaking circles, weekly peacemaking circles, and within 2 months of the program, there were no fights among girls, but they were dealing with topics that are very relevant, like how to have healthy relationships and masking hidden grief, and dealing with trauma, topics that are very relevant for our young people but that are often not addressed. And those are the root causes of these of violence and school discipline issues that are often unaddressed.
And this
so
is
we
a
want to develop
again for our listeners. Yes, and for our listeners, this will be next week, January 25th from 9 a.m. to 12 noon at City Year 287 Columbus Avenue in Boston. This is a coalition, the Massachusetts Coalition. Several organizations are going to be a part to dismantle the cradle-to-prison pipeline, and it's a full coalition meeting. I'm sure, Barbara Best, that you are also trying to bring as many parents to the table as possible, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, all are welcome, and there'll be breakfast, and we'd be delighted for parents to attend and young people directly affected by school push-out policies.
Great. Well, thank you very much for being a guest on my program. We've been talking to Barbara Best, and if you'd like to go to their website, it's www.childrensdefense.com. ChildrensDefense.com. Again, this meeting will take place here in Massachusetts on January 25th. This is a nationwide program, so you can go to their website and find out more about it. Thank you so much for being a guest on my program today, Barbara Best.
Thank you, Carol.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. We have talked about the historical relevance of Dr. King and his era and those who came before him, and now we're talking about the relevant issues of our day. Barbara Best was just talking about what's taking place here in Massachusetts. This is not just an issue that we're facing here in the United States. I know these issues are being faced in other areas, particularly urban areas around the world, including France and the UK and parts of Africa and parts of Asia. How can we touch the lives of young people, keep them on track, keep a foot on them so that they will stay on track, and do it in a way so that they, too, can grow up and become the young kings of our future? We have a lot of work that's left for us to do, and as I go back and think about the letter from the Birmingham jail, I just want to probably read one more section that will just let you know how powerful Dr. King was. He said things like, this is also from this letter, just as Socrates felt it was necessary to create a tension in the minds so that individuals could rise from the bondage of myths and half-truths to the unfettered realm of creative analysis and objective appraisal, so must we need see the need for nonviolent gadflies to create the kind of tension in society that will help men rise from the dark depths of prejudice and racism to the majestic heights of understanding and brotherhood. I'm hoping that you will become a nonviolent gadfly, being just enough of an agitator where you can provide new light and understanding, whether it's dealing with multicultural issues or sexism or gender issues or age issues, but a way where we can have a greater sense of dialogue no matter where we happen to live, no matter who we are certainly our brother and our sister's keeper. Thank you so much for listening to our show today. Go check out all the writings of Dr. King. We hope that you will attend the upcoming coalition session that we talked about or find out about it happening in your respective city or town. Have a great weekend. Stay warm wherever you happen to be, and we'll be back next Thursday. This is Carol Copeland-Thomas, and we will see you next week.